A mesa dessa manhã tem como tema a importância do autoconhecimento para os paliativistas e o mediador é o Dr. Kleber Lincoln Gomes, a quem tenho a honra de chamar para aqui o palco. Kleber é médico psiquiatra, presidente da Associação Integração Social de Itajubá, mantenedora da Faculdade de Medicina de Itajubá e do Hospital de Clínica de Itajubá. É professor titular das disciplinas Psiquiatria 1 e 2. A dinâmica é a mesma de ontem. Após a apresentação de cada um dos nossos três convidados desta mesa, teremos um momento cultural cuidadosamente concebido para aquecer as nossas almas. E depois, um intervalo de meia hora antes de retomarmos à fase de perguntas da plateia. Kleber, obrigada. É com você.
Obrigado. Obrigado, Ana Luísa. Bom dia a todos. Bem-vindos a mais um dia desse trabalho maravilhoso que o Premier nos tem proporcionado. Tenho um orgulho, prazer, uma satisfação muito grande de estar novamente aqui, nesse palco, porque eu estou desde o começo, a convite do meu amigo e irmão Samir, e eu vim exatamente no começo do trabalho para cuidar, para ajudá-lo a preparar os funcionários, os profissionais, para que pudessem lidar melhor com esse tipo de paciente tão difícil que nós lidamos. E hoje eu estou numa mesa exatamente para isso, né? Cuidando dos cuidadores. Considero que esse trabalho é tão ou mais importante ainda do que cuidar diretamente dos pacientes, porque sabemos que não é todo mundo que tem esse perfil de lidar com situação tão difícil quanto a situação de terminalidade, quanto a doença crônica, quanto as dores, etc. Então, eles precisam ser cuidados, precisam ser preparados tecnicamente para que esse trabalho seja bem desenvolvido. Demorei um pouco a vir, tive muitas questões profissionais, pessoais, e confesso, Samir, que eu vou demorar um pouco mais para voltar, porque o que eu encontrei no Premier dessa vez foi de uma evolução extraordinária, não só do ponto de vista físico, do ponto de vista estrutural, da beleza que se transformou aquela entrada, mas também do conteúdo, da qualidade do pessoal que vem aqui e que fala e que transmite o seu conhecimento, que vem cada vez mais agregando até a mesma população. Hoje, cuidado paliativo não é mais uma coisa esquisita, como era no início, né? Hoje é uma ciência muito bem classificada dentro da medicina e vem desenvolvendo um trabalho extraordinário. Para iniciar o nosso trabalho, para falar de como posso ser um profissional de cuidados paliativos habilidoso e compassivo e sobreviver, a doutora Liz Bryan. Eu vou ler novamente o currículo dela, porque é um currículo que tem que ser lido várias vezes para vocês verem a qualidade dessa nossa convidada. Ela pertence ao St. Christopher Hospice de Londres. Ela tem formação em enfermagem de cuidados paliativos, psicoterapia de aconselhamento, educação interprofissional e avaliação educacional. Durante 12 anos, ela lecionou em período parcial na Faculdade de Enfermagem e Obstetrícia Florence Nightingale, no King's College de London, apoiando a prestação de educação acadêmica baseada em evidências paliativas e no final de vida. Este é um papel que ela renunciou para se concentrar em tempo integral na liderança como diretora de educação e treinamento na St. Christopher, o design do edifício e conceito do Learning Hub. Agora, como consultora de educação, Liz está comprometida em impulsionar o desenvolvimento local, nacional e internacional de cuidados paliativos e culturalmente apropriados e de fim de vida. Seu foco particular é projetar e avaliar programas de aprendizagem que tenha um impacto na prática. A enfermeira projetou o programa Kelkan, que agora está sendo entregue por instituições satélites no Reino Unido e no exterior, inclusive no Brasil. Doutora Liz Bryan.
So, good morning. It's really good to be here again. I just want to acknowledge that I'm learning a huge amount so far, even this week, particularly in the work group yesterday afternoon. It was a really good experience to share thinking and to get to know a smaller group, obviously, of Brazilian professionals. You can't hear me, can you? Because it's gone. You can. So I'm just sort of reflecting this morning on what I'm going to take back to the UK and the many conversations that I've had with people and how I'm learning some new concepts. I really enjoyed the film yesterday and some of the terms which I'd not heard of. I don't know whether they're the same in English, but it was a really good, lots and lots of learning. I'm also having some very interesting conversations with my colleague Amira, who's looking after me very well. So I am going to just say a little bit, but there's so much to say on this subject that I really feel that I'm not doing it justice. So I feel I'm really skimming the surface in this presentation. So these are some thoughts, but by no means is it the whole picture. I'm going to spend a little bit of time just looking at what do we mean by compassion. I thought it would, the links then with emotional labour, and I thought I'd mention about the National Health Service and how compassion, the word compassion has become a term that's used a lot. That noise is my fault. And the difficulty of actually overusing terms sometimes so that they become meaningless. So we sometimes have to go back and check that our assumptions about a term are correct. And then a little bit about the problem of workforce burnout, which is a real issue in the UK in our National Health Service. And then just very, very briefly, just very, very superficially looking at personal and organisational strategies to prevent burnout. And the reason I'm not going to do too much on that is because that's what we're doing in the work groups. We're looking at strategies, and I don't want to direct or... you know, that work needs to be ours in our afternoon groups. So according to the Oxford English Dictionary, compassion comes from the Latin compati, meaning to suffer with. And I looked at some academic literature and the definitions of compassion that resonated for me. They're all very similar in English, but compassion involves feeling for a person who is suffering and being motivated to act to help them. And also a virtuous response that seeks to address the suffering and needs of a person through relational understanding and action. And I suppose really what the literature is saying is that compassion is different from empathy. Empathy is the feeling for someone. Compassion is then being motivated to action, to do something about it. And that's really important. I think that's key, really, to our understanding of, as palliative care providers, we are not just to feel, to suffer with, but we are to be equipped to do something about it. There's nothing more stressful than feeling with someone and then feeling totally de-skilled or underskilled and incompetent. It's very stressful. And for many practitioners, that really is the key to their stress and ultimate burnout. So I just wanted to refer to some work that was done a long time ago where the first time that emotional labour was described as something that we provide as workers. We understand physical labour. You know, we understand if we employ someone to dig our roads up or plant our gardens or whatever. We understand intellectual labour, understanding emotional labour is a little bit more complex, and certainly in healthcare, but even particularly nursing, it is a combination of all three. You need to be physically fit and able. You need to be cognitively aware and have knowledge and understanding, and you also need to be emotionally competent in order to provide that relational care that is such an important part of compassion. So Hochschild, Arlie Hochschild, wrote about the emotional labour of being an air steward or stewardess. This is of particular interest because, believe it or not, a few years ago I couldn't get on an aeroplane. Fortunately, I can now. And the emotional labour of being an air steward or stewardess is obviously because you have maybe, 100, 200 people in a metal box, a long way up in the air, and you're trying to contain the emotion. You're trying to manage, people's anxiety, people drinking too much, people perhaps having rows, and you're managing that. And Arlie Hochschild was interested in what impact that had on the private lives of those workers. And discovered that actually, because it wasn't recognised that they were having relational problems outside of work, they were drinking too much, they were using recreational drugs to ameliorate the stress. And then Pam Smith said, well, if that's the case for air stewards and stewardesses, how much more is it the case for nurses? So she began to look at emotional labour in the experience of nursing. And if we look at the emotional labour of looking after the dying and their relatives, just consider what we confront on a daily basis and how we then respond in our professional role, the pain, the suffering, the neediness, the fear, the aggression. And then we attempt to respond with empathy, with kindness, with patience, with calmness, offering hope. We have all sorts of different concerns that we hear on a daily basis. I'm going to read them so that they can be translated. But, how could this be happening so fast? Am I dying? What about food and fluids? If we had the right medicines, treatments, this wouldn't be happening. Things were fine until that medicine started. Isn't the medicine speeding this up? My mother's too drowsy. My mother's too restless. What will it be like? How will we know? Can't you do something? And each of us have particular buttons that get pressed. You know, some of us are particularly impacted when children are involved, or when the patient is young, or when the patient is isolated and appears lonely, when the patient or relatives don't seem to be able to express any emotions, when there's anger. Not all of those will cause you particular stress or anxiety, but there will be some, or one particular, for your own personal reasons. So engaging with those we care for brings us closer to their pain. There's a cost to us. Feelings of helplessness when faced with insoluble problems. And then we can start taking those problems home with you, or home with us, and that then impacts, doesn't it, on our lives outside. I, only in a very small way, but for 9 years, I worked in a hospice unit at night, which is when I did my psychotherapy training, and I had 3 small children, and I would come home from a night duty. I maybe have had 3 deaths during the night, and you know the emotional labour managing that and managing the relatives, and I'd probably been absolute, you wouldn't know, I'd be calm and serene at work, and then I'd come home in the morning and there'd be a sink full of washing up from my children, and I go, what are you doing? And they would say, have you had a bad night, Mum? How our giving out can spill, it leaks, doesn't it, into our private lives. So what is stress? Just stress is quite healthy. We all need a bit of stress. I had a bit of stress as I came up to the podium. You know, that helps us to perform, to do things well, to give our best. But it's temporary. It's a temporary imbalance in a person's emotional state and their behaviour. You know, a bit like my explosion over the washing up. And it happens when we're under more pressure than we can perhaps at that moment cope with. And it's a balance. It's keeping a balance, isn't it? It's the demands made on us and our capacity to respond. But what does stress mean to us? What causes stress? And Benner and Rubel, I think I like this list. When we have disruptions of meanings or understandings, I always think about that period after 9/11, where so many people around the world, we were all impacted by that terrible event, and it caused many people to reevaluate, to rethink the world, just to, you know, people were walking around saying, how could this happen? How could it happen? I can remember seeing the pictures of the plane going into the building thinking, oh, that must be a movie. It's just so incredible. So that's an extreme case, but on a day-to-day basis, we can be challenged about our beliefs. What makes sense? What had meaning, and now maybe we have to reevaluate it. When things don't work the way they're supposed to work, that can be really stressful. You get in the car in the morning to go to work and it doesn't start, and you've got to take the kids to school and you've got to do this and you've got an appointment, and those things cause stress. feeling threatened, that experience of feeling harm or loss or challenge, where you feel your own being is challenged, is threatened in some way. And when you don't have the skill, when you know you don't have the skill, when you require a new skill, it's very, very stressful, isn't it, when you move from one role to another, and you've been very competent, and that's why you've been recruited into a new post, and then you get into a new post and you feel totally disempowered and you think, what have I done? Some work of Barbara Munro, who was our social worker at St. Christopher's, and then she became our CEO. She wrote a book with Nigel Sykes, who I know has visited Premier. But she says, you know, when individuals are stressed, they manifest all these sort of characteristics. And it's really important for us as colleagues to look out for these traits or these behaviours in our colleagues and in ourselves. And they really do... there's quite a spectrum there. Some people will become over-involved and stay late and you can't get them to go home. And other people become very rigid when they're stressed and that it's time to leave and they just walk out the door without finishing what they're doing. These are all different characteristics. But also organisations that where there's high levels of stress will manifest things like conflict, power struggles, rivalry, hostility towards management, rapid staff turnover, high sickness rates, general lack of enthusiasm. And actually, if I look at that list, that basically is the NHS at the moment. So, compassion in the UK National Health Service. In the UK, compassion is one of the six core values in the NHS Constitution. I was going to show you the link, but I won't. But do look it up. It's very interesting. And why is it? Because we've had many exposés of serious failings, which have then... the Department of Health have felt we've got to do something about this. There's more to it, though, isn't there? If you want to change things, just writing a policy or giving people guidance isn't the answer. You have to change culture. So these are just some examples around the time that compassion began was highlighted as needing to be a core value of the NHS. So very disturbingly... around the same time, I suppose, as the National End of Life Care Strategy was being published. But, you know, people not being given anything to drink. Some really important and fundamental care just not being delivered. Some real sort of looking at why this isn't happening. What's going on in our workforce? What's going on amongst our staff? That they're failing to provide just the basic needs of patients. So, burnout. Around the same time, the Point of Care Foundation, which is a part of the King's Fund, really important at looking at the culture within healthcare in the UK, held a conference, and it was nurses, doctors, psychologists, chaplains, managers, and it was to look at the whole issue of compassion. And they came up with a similar sort of definition. Compassion is a deep awareness of the suffering of another coupled with the wish to relieve it. But it includes honesty. It may involve both courage and generosity, and frequently requiring that caregivers give something of themselves. Again, back to that emotional labour. And what contributes to preventing compassion? Just natural human defences, stress and burnout. I think b- this is very pertinent, this conflict between perceptions of professionalism and compassion. People in a lot of the professions, and I hear this a lot, which ties in with the training that emphasizes professional detachment. I hear student nurses saying, oh, I got upset, I cried, and I was told you mustn't cry when you're a nurse. Ugh. I thought that had changed, but clearly not. Sometimes our patients need us to, or certainly forgive us for suffering with them. It's not about crying for ourselves, but crying perhaps for our patients or relatives. And I'm not talking about completely breaking down and losing control. I'm talking about emotion being evoked and being able to manifest emotion. And we do have a lack of systematic role modeling in our healthcare settings. So what is burnout? So this is just a quote from some work by Christina Maslach. You know, when you have to care for so many people and you begin to suffer with emotional overload, it's just too much. I'm like a wire that has too much electricity flowing through it. I burned out and emotionally disconnected from others. So Maslach says burnout is a syndrome of emotional exhaustion, apparently, and I know it for myself. It is like the fatigue that people with advanced disease might feel. No matter how much sleep you get, no matter how much rest, you can't get re-energized. People will go on holiday and come back feeling exactly the same way. You depersonalize in that you no longer see people, but patients or cases, or they become objects, and reduce personal accomplishment. So you actually feel you don't get very much from the job. It no longer meets your needs as a role. You feel that you're not doing anything valuable. You feel you're failing in some way. And Maslach says that this is a continuum, that actually you can, in one day, you can feel exhausted. I can come on duty and feel full of energy, and then something might happen and I then might feel perhaps demoralized and exhausted. We oscillate, don't we, on a day-to-day basis. It's when we're up at one end of that spectrum for a prolonged period of time, very much like clinical depression. So the symptoms of depression need to be present for a reasonable period of time for us to be able to say somebody is clinically depressed. The same with burnout. It's when a colleague or yourselves, when you feel exhausted, you feel sort of fairly negative and hostile and ineffective for a prolonged period of time, you need to ask yourself, am I burnt out? Dr. Riemann, she's got a lovely book called Kitchen Wisdom, and it's worth just looking at. There's stories, and she says staff burn out, not because they don't care, but because they don't grieve. You know, do we allow ourselves to grieve? Not in the way where this is not my mother, this is not my husband that's dying, but when human beings die, it's sad. And sometimes we have formed a professional relationship with that person, and we need to acknowledge that, we need to do something. The expectation that we can be immersed in suffering and loss daily and not be touched by it is as unrealistic as expecting to be able to walk through water without getting wet. So how do you know when you're stressed? That's my question to you. Can you tell? And how do you look after yourself? Only you can answer that, so I'm sorry, I don't have any answers, and I think that's the whole point of these afternoon work groups.
I'm just going to show you a video now, okay? It has got subtitles on it, you'll be pleased to hear, if it works. So why do I like that video? Because it actually talks about us as well. It talks about what's going on in our lives, that we have things that are significant and that we bring into our relationships with our patients. We can't help but bring who we are into the workplace. And so it's so important. I'll see if I can go back. You will notice that I set that video into the quote, "You matter because you are you, and you matter until the last moment of your life." That applies to us as well as it does to our patients and relatives. If they matter, so do we. It's obvious, isn't it? We have to make sure that when we're educating, when we're working with colleagues who we are trying to equip to care for dying and be present, we need to be thinking about their emotional welfare, their how they are looking after themselves, but how we can also provide structures and spaces for them to be emotionally supported. So those are all the sort of usual things that we do. Some appeal to us, some don't. Some of us love music, some of us like a hot bath with bubbly stuff and candles. Some of us love to go out with friends, some of us love to be on our own. There's all sorts of things that we can do to make sure that we are caring for ourselves. But also just recognizing when really something has touched us very deeply and we need to talk to somebody, when we actually need more professional support. And that is not a failure. That is looking after ourselves so that we can be more present and compassionate to our patients. And the other, finishing with Maslach again, what Maslach points out in her research is that it isn't just about being overloaded with work. There are parts of our work life that also contribute. Six dimensions she identified. Yes, workload is one, but we need to have control, and control comes when we feel skilled, when we feel we know what we're doing. Reward may not be financial. Reward may be affirmation, working in an environment where you're supported and supervised, and just your potential is recognized by your managers and your organization. That's really important. People will become very quickly burnt out if they don't feel recognized for what they do. Forming a community. I think one of the things that hospices do really very well, and I can see it here at Premier, is that trying to create a sense of identity for a community so that within an organisation you feel proud to work for that organisation, and that you know what the values of that organisation are, and you can support them. Fairness, so justice, a sense that everybody's treated the same, that people are rewarded for the work that they do, and that people are treated fairly when maybe they have issues in their own lives. And again, this idea of values. Value conflict is one of the biggest causes, I think, of burnout in the National Health Service. You know, providing, it's great having compassion as a part of the constitution, but if the culture of the organization and the structures and the systems make you feel like an object and make you feel like the patients are really not valued, that it's impossible to provide person-centered care, then that's going to cause stress over time. So to finish, really, these are some management or organisational processes that we can make sure that we provide within our organizations to prevent burnout, which comes from too much stress or stress over a prolonged period of time with no relief. You know, actually, supervision can be one-to-one or it can be group, which, you know, is the performance appraisal. So when your skills or potential is recognized, debriefing after particularly challenging cases. Effective communication. One of the things that's very stressful, I think, is when you're in an organization and you don't really know what's going on. So when management continually inform and keep you updated, so communication systems are really important. Skill development, I've already mentioned, how important to make sure that our workforce are trained and have the necessary skills and knowledge, and this sense of work group cohesion. So providing spaces, social spaces or other, where people can feel that they belong, form an identity as a community or as a team. Needless to say, the Quelca program, one of the core sessions is around self and colleague care, and it's fundamental to providing good end-of-life care and palliative care. Thank you.